begin again with our motivation. And since the teachings last night, throughout this world, many living beings have died. Of course, none of them that died today thought they were going to die. They always thought they had another day, another hour, or that somehow death would not happen to them. But death comes when it wants, and we have to follow it. So death is not a morbid thing. We don't meditate on it to make ourselves depressed. But by recognizing our mortality and that we have limited time with this precious human life, it helps us to set our priorities with clarity, and it helps us to clear away from our minds all the things that we do that waste our time. Because from the perspective of our mortality, following all of our clingings and attachments and graspings to get what we want, you know, none of that makes much sense, considering that we're going to have to separate from it when we die. And similarly, letting our mind stay down in the dumps and depressed and full of self-pity, considering that we have limited time in a precious human body, also doesn't make very much sense. So in that way, the reflection on mortality, on death, you know, presents to us the question of how should we spend our time. That is very valuable. And then it motivates us to do that without getting distracted, without getting lazy. This kind of awareness, then let's do something valuable in our lives, such as cultivate bodhicitta, the altruistic intention, and to do all of our activities, including listening to this talk, with that kind of motivation. Sometimes when we meditate on our own mortality, we come up with the wrong conclusions. Like we get depressed and say, well, what's the use if I'm going to die? That's the wrong conclusion to the meditation. Yeah. Or we think, oh my goodness, I've got to do everything all at once and be enlightened by Tuesday, and I can't sleep anymore, and I can't smile anymore, and I can't do anything. I've got to study and meditate at 25-8. And, you know, and that's not going to work. Okay. So, you know, we need to be aware of what our ability is, what we can do in a reasonable way, and do that without pushing ourselves, without driving ourselves crazy, but also without having the mind that says, well, you know, I'll do it mañana en la mañana. Yeah? There's plenty of time. Yeah. So that also doesn't work. So, you know, we have to really see how to use these meditations so that they spur our enthusiastic energy, but without going to the extreme of pushing ourselves. And how we give ourselves time to rest without going to the extreme of just lying around and keeping ourselves busy doing all sorts of things that aren't really very important. Which we're quite good at doing, aren't we? And we can, I don't know about you, but I can explain how all the things I do that waste time actually have great meaning and are important to do. Yeah. I don't know if any of you have that ability, but yeah, if you ever need any rationalizations or justifications, ask me. I can give them, I can provide them very easily. Effortlessly. I wish my Dharma practice were that effortless. Okay. So, we're continuing in Gomchen Lamrim. Last time we talked about, you know, what the meaning of renunciation was, especially if you're following the Bodhisattva path. And then we also talked about the value of monastic ordination as the basis for practicing the path to liberation. And then the next part, with which path to overcome cyclic existence, then Gomchen Lamrim says, the excellent path to overcome samsara consists of the three trainings. Okay, next to serving billions of Buddhas for as many eons as there are water molecules in the Ganges River, with food and drink, parasols and banners, and rows of butter lamps, with an attitude of faith, if someone observes a single precept for a day and a night at a time when the sacred Dharma is completely disintegrating and the Sugata's teaching is coming to an end, the merit of the latter will be 10 million times greater. And that's a quotation from the King of Concentration Sutra, the Samadhi Raja Sutra. So, yeah, this is really talking about the value of monastic ordination and keeping one precept, and also for lay people, you know, taking the five precepts and even keeping one precept. Very, very valuable. You know, it's more valuable keeping one precept for day and night in this degenerate age than it is making all these incredible offerings for as of beautiful things for as many eons as molecules of water in the Ganges River. That amount of merit for making those kind of offerings with just a, you know, just an attitude of faith, not with bodhicitta or, you know, aspiration for liberation, but just an attitude of faith. So keeping the, you know, the pratimoksha precepts are more valuable. This is the quotation that many of the Tibetan lamas refer to when they, you know, say that it's very valuable to keep ordination in this life, and it's the one that motivates them to give many people ordination, even if they don't expect all those people to keep the ordination for their entire life. Because they figure however long the person keeps the ordination, that much good karma they've created. So, you know, that's their way of thinking, and it makes sense. And also from the viewpoint of the studies they do in the monasteries, the philosophical studies, to do those well, you need a lot of people who have a lot of different ideas and different opinions. So they want to ordain a lot of people. And they figure that you ordain them, especially when they're young. And then, you know, many of them are children. Then you wait and see when they grow up how they turn out. And, you know, some will stay on and some will leave, and that's okay. The ones who stay on, it's very good. They continue the studies. The ones who leave created merit for the time they were there. Okay, and that's how they think. And in Tibet society, you know, it's kind of accepted if somebody chooses to disrobe nowadays. Yeah, because the idea is usually if somebody's doing that, then they're going towards, you know, they can earn a lot of money, or they can go to the West or something like that. In terms of the Western Sangha, they ordain, you know, Westerners with that same kind of motivation. But my experience is that doesn't always turn out so well, because you have people who, put it this way, if you're a Tibetan, you know what you're getting into when you ordain, because you lived in the Tibetan society with monks and nuns, you have relatives who were monks and nuns, you know what you're getting into. Westerners come to Buddhism completely cold. They go into ordination really not understanding what it is. And then afterwards, since they don't have monasteries to go to, and they have to support themselves, then many of them become discouraged and they disrobe, which is quite unfortunate, because that gives Westerners a not very good impression of the Sangha, which is unfortunate. And it also gives the Tibetans that same impression, because they haven't, they don't screen the people and prepare them for ordination properly. It's just, you want to ordain, come back, you know, I'm giving ordination next week or tomorrow or whenever it is, come back with your robes and that's it. So, yeah. So that's why here at the Abbey we do it a bit differently, because we want to, we have the idea that when the Sangha is new in a place, you know, in the Western world, then you have to establish it well and establish it soundly and screen people properly and prepare them properly so that they know what they're getting into. Just to give you an example, okay, one of my friends was leading the, at Tushita, they started to have a preparatory course of a week for Westerners who wanted to ordain with His Holiness. So there was one middle-aged man who came and was doing the course, and in the middle of the course, my friend who was leading it found out that the man did not realize that he was going to have to be celibate if he ordained. And that he was in fact planning on going back and living with his wife and kids after ordination. So it's this kind of lack of knowledge, you know. Thank goodness there was that course, and, you know, the leader kind of corrected this man's wrong idea. But, you know, there's many people who, you know, maybe their wrong ideas don't get corrected. And yeah, and people who have different kind of problems, which make it difficult for them to be ordained. Anyway, that's a digression. The purpose of that quote was really to encourage people who are ordained to keep their ordination by saying how much good karma you create by keeping it in this degenerate age. Any questions? Yeah, I got off on a tangent, as I often do.
It's off kind of also when somebody disrobes in the discussion. Is that negative karma, per se?
Yeah, if somebody disrobes, is it negative karma? It is, if they break their precept, their root precept, that definitely is negative karma. If they return their precepts, their ordination, before they break them, then they don't accumulate the negative karma of breaking their precepts. However, I don't think you can say that that is a good imprint to put on your mind stream, that of giving back the precepts. You have to look quite clearly at what the motivation is when somebody disrobes. And it usually, not always, but usually has something to do with the eight worldly concerns. Anything else? So, and actually in according to the Vinaya, to even receive the precepts to start with, you have to have the intention to keep them your whole life. So, it should be like that. Okay, then, Gomchen Lamrim continues, keep this in mind. The tantra requested by Subahu says, of all the Vinaya, with the exception of the signs and observances of monasticism. Okay, so the signs of monasticism, shaved hair, wearing the robes, no cosmetics, no ornaments and things like that. And the observances, those mean the sangha karma, the official actions of the karma, such as doing the confession and restoration of the vows, making decisions about sangha property, entering the rains retreat, the invitation at the end of the rains retreat, all those kind of formal actions. So with the exception of the signs, the robes and so on, and doing those formal, the sangha karmas, okay, a householder mantra practitioner, that mantra practitioner, someone who's practicing the tantra, should practice the rest of the pure ethical discipline of personal liberation that I taught. Okay, so this is where the Buddha is saying that even if you are a lay tantric practitioner, you know, don't wear robes, don't shave your head, don't do the sangha karmas, you can't do those, but all the other precepts you should practice, even though you are a householder, because you're a tantric practitioner, because it's important to keep those precepts and live and keep very pure ethical conduct. So this is also important for people in the West to understand. Many people completely misunderstand tantra and think that tantra is an excuse to have samsara and nirvana mixed in, you know, all rolled up in one. So you can drink and you can have sex and you can gain all these wonderful realizations. But it's not exactly like that. And so this quotation is really, again, saying the importance of basic ethical conduct, whether one is a monastic or not. How important that is. Okay, thus, you who aspire to liberation by your practice of sutra and mantra, each one completing the other, spread and develop the conqueror's teachings. So the utterly certain explanation of the practice of the path shared with intermediate beings is complete. So he really rushed through intermediate stage. It was not even one page. Okay? So, this happens. The idea is, that he said the essence is the three higher trainings in ethical conduct, in concentration, and in wisdom. So the reason for going through it quickly here is that especially the higher training in concentration you cover in the Bodhisattva path with the perfection of meditative stability, and the higher training in wisdom you cover in the Bodhisattva path with the perfection of wisdom. Always interested me how they talk more about ethical conduct here in the context of the middle level of practitioner, even though that also comes as the perfection of ethical conduct in the Bodhisattva path. Yeah. So they don't explain all of the Bodhisattva ethical conduct here, because this is the path that is practice in accord with the intermediate state, intermediate level being who is intent on gaining liberation. Okay. So they say in common, but they haven't really explained it in a full way, figuring that you're going to get it when you get to the advanced path of the Bodhisattva. Okay? However, I thought here what I would do is go through the 37 harmonies with awakening. These are the things that are emphasized very much in the fundamental vehicle path. They are the main practice of somebody who is at the intermediate level. And I feel it's kind of sad nowadays that, you know, these things aren't taught very much in the context of the intermediate level. And because everybody's going into bodhicitta and then going into tantra really, really quickly. Okay? And so missing some of these quite beautiful practices. So I don't plan on going in, into them in depth, but to at least give some awareness of what these 37 harmonies with awakening are, because I think it helps you in your practice of the intermediate state. And also because, you know, we have a lot of contact with our Dharma friends who are fundamental vehicle practitioners. And we should know their path. And we, you know, it's also taught in the Lam Rim, and it's very good for us to practice those same things and not skip over them and not ignore them. Yeah? Because I think especially what happens often is people get pushed into Tantra very soon and they're very busy visualizing themselves as somebody else before they've done the four establishments of mindfulness on their present body and feelings and mind and phenomena. And I think unless you have some realistic sense of, you know, your present basic situation now, our body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, then visualizing ourselves as somebody else with other bodies, feelings, mind, and phenomena, it doesn't have as much impact. You know, what Tantra is trying to do doesn't impact you because you're not really familiar with what you are to start with. Yeah, because our basic ideas about our body, mind, feelings, and phenomena are in la-la land. Yeah? I mean, we talk a lot about just this first one, about the body, you know, and the nature of the body being foul. And, you know, you ask anybody in our society, is the nature of the body foul? And they say, no, the body is beautiful. The body is the source of the ultimate supercalifragilisticexpialidocious pleasure that you could ever have. Yeah? And you know, people are so resistant against doing the meditation of establishing mindfulness on the body. Even people who have been long-term Dharma practitioners. Yeah, I was asked to teach about the four establishments of mindfulness at one Buddhist college. And the students there, I mean, they've been studying Madhyamaka philosophy, they've been studying this, that, and the other thing. When I started talking about the nature of the body, oh, they were so uncomfortable. They did not like that at all, you know? And then when I mentioned what Gelsum, you know, what he said in his commentary about Precious Garland, that if we can't even hold that in mind about body being foul in nature, even though that's something that's evident to our sense perception, how in the world are we going to realize emptiness, which is not evident to our sense perception, and hold that in mind? You know, in other words, if you can't add, how are you going to do calculus? Okay. But we don't like to hear that so much, you know? Okay. So these 37 factors or harmonies with awakening are in different groups. They begin with the four establishments of mindfulness. And then we have the, let's see where that, okay. Then we have the four strivings, okay. Then the four faculties, and no, the five faculties. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I missed one. The four. The okay. Okay. So the four establishments of mindfulness, the four supreme strivings. Okay. The four bases for supernormal power. The five faculties and the five powers. The seven enlightenment or awakening factors, and the Eightfold Noble Path. And that adds up to 47. And if you do the Amundaka practice, when you're visualizing your 34 arms plus your body, speech, and mind, those seven symbolize these 37 harmonies. So these 37 are taught quite extensively in the Pali Canon and Pali commentaries, and they form the basic practice. I mean, this is the higher training in wisdom for the fundamental vehicles. But bodhisattvas do these practices as well. They're described in the ornament for clear realization by Maitreya and in other texts. It's just that very often people study them quickly and go over them but don't do them. Yeah. When His Holiness was going over this about the book, he made the comment that he feels like it's kind of sad that people don't do these practices. That he thinks it would be quite beneficial for them. And I happen to agree. Okay, so just to go briefly through them, the four establishments of mindfulness, I will try not to go into them in too much depth, but you know me. Okay, so like I was saying, there are mindfulness, feelings, mind, and phenomena. So, body. Body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Okay, so they are, they're helping us. Why these four objects in particular are chosen is that they help us counteract four errors in our thinking. Okay, so the first one is conceiving our body to be the place where the self resides. Do you have that feeling? I am here inside my body?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So we have that conception, conceiving our body to be the place where the self resides. That's quite a strong feeling too, isn't it? Yeah. And where in your body do you usually feel you are? Sometimes people feel behind your eyes, somewhere in your head. When you're emotional, you feel like you're here. Yeah. When you're sick, to your stomach. Yeah, we're sick wherever. It's here, wherever the pain is. Okay. But, you know, is there a self that resides in the body? It feels like there is, And historically, people thought there was. I mean, what was this, this little homunculus in the pituitary gland? Yeah. So we develop all sorts of conceptualizations about this self and the body. Another erroneous conception is thinking, is conceiving our feelings to be what the self enjoys and experiences. That seems very real, doesn't it? I feel happy, I feel miserable, I feel indifferent. Okay? So there's a conception that there's an independent I that enjoys and experiences these different feelings. Not that there's just a feeling, you know, and that the person is labeled independent on that, but that there's a real person who experiences these feelings. The third misconception is conceiving our mind to be a real self. I am what thinks and perceives. Yeah? What Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. Yeah, there's a real me that thinks. And I can control my thoughts, and I can control my emotions. Right? Don't we have that idea in there too? Yeah, there's an I that's a controller. And then the fourth preconception is conceiving phenomena, in particular our attitudes and our emotions, our views, different mental factors, is conceiving these as making the self either afflicted or worthwhile. So ideas such as, I have so many problems with anger and jealousy, so, you know, the anger and jealousy, they make me afflictive. Or my confidence makes me a good person, so my attitude, you know, both makes me a worthwhile person. So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, all these self-opinions that we have, self-conceptions, low self-esteem, self-hatred, all of that, it's all based on the idea that there's an independent and that these different mental factors, different mental states, make that self either something stupid or something wonderful. And we buy in, we grasp onto that one really strong, don't we? Yeah? Different, you know, we have, one person has to think, I'm so stupid. You know, I can't think clearly, I can't learn properly, I can't follow instructions, I'm worthless. Another person thinks, I am smart, I can figure anything out, I know better than anybody else. Okay? Both of those are equally afflictive and equally incorrect because there's no independent self that is either of those. And those qualities, whether they're good ones or bad ones, don't make the person good or bad, afflicted or virtuous. Okay? They're simply mental factors. Themselves virtuous or non-virtuous, but they don't make the person virtuous or non-virtuous. Okay? So, but, I mean, just going through those four, boy, we have them, don't they? And they're pretty deep, pretty deeply rooted. Okay. So, and they're all based on this idea of a self that stands alone, is there, in control, created by itself, not dependent on anything else. And the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena are all arranged around that self. Yeah, and at the service of that self. And controlled by that self, even though all it takes is about 30 seconds of breathing meditation for us to figure out that we can't control our body or our mind. But never mind, we like to think that we can. Okay? So also meditating on these four help us to overcome four other wrong conceptions, in addition to these four, but four distorted conceptions. So meditating on the body, okay, being mindful of the body. Now we have the internal body, you know, the external body, the external environment. But the idea, especially with the internal body, is to really look at what this body is made out of, where it came from, what its nature is right now, what it becomes after we die. And any way we look at this body, you know, it's not something very pleasant. It's pretty foul. Agree or not agree? I'm sure you say yes, but you don't really. You know you better say yes. The inside, my body is not foul. My body is beautiful. My guts smell like perfume. Yeah. Everybody else's insides are disgusting, but mine are beautiful. Okay. So when we meditate deeply on the mindfulness of the body, we overcome the distorted conception that the body is pure. And we begin to realize the body is foul. And this is actually quite helpful in many ways. And I think especially at the time of death, when we can so easily start to grasp at our body and not want to leave our body, if we at that time recall that this body is something foul, it's nothing special to hang on to, then it can help us release that clinging to stay with this body. Yeah. Because why should we hang on to it? I mean, look what it is. Why do we cherish it so much? When, you know, all the orifices excrete very disgusting things. And if you pull away the skin, the inside is disgusting. So why are we hanging onto this body? So this is not meaning that we should all go out and kill ourselves. I am not advocating that, free ourselves from the body. Because it's ignorance that makes us take this body. So until we get rid of the ignorance, just separating from this body is not going to do any good, because we're just going to take another one. Okay. But at the time of death, not to cling onto this body is very helpful. Then, when we meditate on feelings of pleasure or happiness, pain or unpleasant feelings, indifferent feelings, you know, what we begin to see is that all of these feelings, you know, for us limited beings who are under the influence of ignorance, all these feelings are unsatisfactory. They're in the nature of dukkha. Yeah. That no matter how you cut it, yeah, we've been talking a lot about samsaric happiness, that no matter how you look at samsaric happiness or try to create it, it is always unsatisfactory. It doesn't last. Yeah, the activity that gives us that pleasure, if we keep doing it, the pleasure goes away and it becomes painful instead. Okay, so we begin to free ourselves from the distorted conception that feelings are pleasurable, and begin to see that they are all the nature of dukkha. Then when we meditate on the mind, establishing mindfulness on the mind, which His Holiness usually teaches as meditation on the conventional nature of the mind, the clear and cognizant nature of the mind. By doing that, we free ourselves from the mistaken conception that the mind is permanent. And especially because we often see the mind as the basis, the final basis of designation for the self. So if we think the mind is permanent, then that fuels the idea that there's a permanent self. But when you pay very close attention and mindfulness on the mind, it becomes evident that the mind is changing in each nanosecond. Yeah? That there's nothing at all permanent about the mind to grab onto. Okay? So that helps free us from the wrong conception that things that are impermanent are permanent. And then mindfulness of phenomena is mindfulness about various mental states and mental factors. So it can include like the five hindrances, you know, going through the 51 mental factors, or, you know, many of these sets in the 37 harmonies with awakening are mental factors. So looking at all of those. But it frees us from thinking that that any of these is a self. Okay, so it frees us from the wrong conception that things that are not the self are the self. Things that do not have a self. There's slightly different meanings depending on how you put it. Yeah, from the Pali version, it's thinking that things that are not the self are the self. Because we tend to think these different mental factors are the person. From the Mahayana viewpoint, the wrong conception is thinking that things that lack a self have a self, referring to the fact that the mental factors themselves are empty of inherent existence, and so is the I that is designated in dependence on them. Okay. These four establishments of mindfulness also coincide with the Four Noble Truths, or they help us to understand the four truths of the noble ones of the Aryas. So the mindfulness, establishing mindfulness on the body, helps us understand the first one, true dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature of samsara, so much of which is based on the body. Okay. Feelings, mindfulness and feelings helps us understand the second truth, the truth of the origin of dukkha, because it's in response to pleasant, unpleasant, and indifferent feelings that we generate attachment, aversion, and ignorance, and all the other kinds of virtuous and non-virtuous mental factors that become the source of our dukkha, of our unsatisfactory experiences. By meditating on the mind, mindfulness of the mind, it helps us understand the truth of cessation, because we begin to get a feeling with the mind, you know, the mind is impermanent, you can't find the mind anywhere, you can't pinpoint exactly what it is or hold any moment of it. So you begin to realize that dukkha and its origins, its causes, can be eliminated. So that helps us understand true cessation. And then mindfulness of the phenomena all these mental factors helps us understand the truth of the path, because all these mental factors, some of them are to be abandoned and some of them are to be practiced. So the ones that are to be practiced become the truth of the path, and they overcome the ones that are to be abandoned. Okay, so there's actually quite a bit in these four establishments of mindfulness, and that's why we had a teaching on them that lasted well over a year. Okay, and it's all on the web, and I really recommend, if you can, to go through them. They're really quite wonderful teachings. Yeah. And our winter retreat this winter, we're going to have two kind of streams. One stream doing Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga and Lamrim, the other stream doing these four establishments of mindfulness. Okay, then next comes the four supreme strivings. Actually, the Tibetans often translate this as the four abandonments. But when you read what they are, abandonments doesn't make much sense. And what I finally figured out when I was able to see the Sanskrit word for abandonment and for striving is they're very similar. So I think somehow, you know, there was an error in the spelling of the Sanskrit term so that the translators thought it was saying abandonment instead of striving. That's my theory. Okay. Okay, so these four supreme strivings are to put our effort into preventing non-virtue, so afflictions and destructive actions, from arising, okay? For example, by restraining our senses. Very good practice, you know, to abandon non-virtue is not to let our senses wander all around, because as soon as we cognize objects, we experience pleasure, pain, or neutral, and then the afflictions of attachment, anger, and ignorance arise, okay? So restraining the senses is very good to, a very good way to apply effort to prevent non-virtue from arising. Okay, then the second one is to arouse an aspiration and apply effort and strive to abandon non-virtue already generated by applying the antidotes. So the first one was don't generate non-virtue that hasn't come up yet. Yeah, so if you don't have weeds in your garden, prevent the weeds from coming. The second one is if you have weeds, pull them. Okay, so pulling the weeds is applying the antidotes. And so we know from our study of the Lamrim and Lojong, the thought training, that, you know, there are all these different antidotes to apply to the various mental afflictions that arise. The third is to arouse aspiration and apply effort to generate new virtues that we haven't generated already. For example, by cultivating the four establishments of mindfulness and the seven awakening factors, meditating on bodhicitta. So any kind of virtue that hasn't yet arisen in our mind, to put effort into making it arise. And then the fourth one is to aspire and have effort to maintain and enhance the virtues that have already arisen in our mind. Okay, so, you know, whatever we've meditated on, we've created virtue, we've started that process of familiarizing ourselves with it, so to maintain that and enhance it. Okay? So, you know, when we say, may the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow, that's the last two, you know, the virtue that hasn't arisen to generate it, that what that has arisen, may it grow even more, and that which has arisen, maybe the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow, may that born have no decline, but increase forevermore, which again has the same meaning. May we maintain it and it not decrease. Okay? So it's kind of related to these last two here of generating new virtues and then maintaining and enhancing the ones we've already created. Okay? Then the four bases of supernormal power, those are the next. So, okay, so we have four establishments of mindfulness, four supreme strivings, that's eight. Then these four supernormal powers are going to make 12. Okay, so these four are actually concentrations. They're types of concentrations. Yeah. And they're the single-pointed concentration of aspiration, effort, intention, and investigation. And through practicing these four concentrations, yeah, then we develop, practitioners develop a special power to emanate and transform things. So that's why it's called the four bases of supernormal power, because the supernormal powers, you know, the Sanskrit term is iddhi, it refers to kind of these magical things you can do, walk on water, you know, go under the earth, making your body very large, emanating many bodies, dissolving the emanations back into one body, transforming an ugly place into a beautiful one without cleaning it. You know, so all these kind of supernormal things that have to do with physical objects, okay? So if you're a bodhisattva, then these things are very useful because they enable you to attend teachings in many different places and to get there very quickly. And they enable you to connect with disciples that you can benefit very easily. Okay. So the purpose of these powers is not just so that you have supernormal powers and then, you know, you can do all these magical things and then other people will think that you're really cool and far out and maybe we'll give you money and a big reputation. That's not the purpose of generating them. The purpose for bodhisattvas is to generate them to use in your practice so that you can attain enlightenment quicker and be of greater benefit to sentient beings. Okay? Yeah, aspiration, effort, intention, and investigation. Okay, so the four establishments of mindfulness are the mental factors of wisdom and mindfulness. The four supreme strivings are the mental factor of effort. And the four bases of supernormal power are the mental factor of concentration associated with the mental factors of aspiration, effort, intention, and investigation. Okay.
The mental factor of concentration associated with those four?
Yes. The mental factor of concentration associated with those four are the four bases of supernormal powers. How do you gain supernormal powers? By having deep states of samadhi. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then I'm going to explain mental factors that help you gain deep states of samadhi. Okay? So there's two factors contributing to concentration. The one is determined striving, a strong effort, you know, very determined, and that's common to all four of these concentrations of aspiration, effort, intention, and investigation. Okay? Then aspiration is a deep desire or wish to gain supernormal powers. Okay? And it fuels our efforts to gain samadhi. Okay? Then effort is the second one, and it spurs the cultivation of concentration that leads to supernormal powers. So first, you know, if you're going to gain these powers, you have to have the aspiration. If you don't have the aspiration, then you're not going to do it. Okay? And if you have the aspiration, then you're going to put forth effort. Okay? If you have effort, then you need to calm your mind and make it tranquil, and that is done by means of intention. So that's the third one. The intention helps you to make your mind tranquil, clear, and then through the resulting clarity of mind you get from that, then you gain the concentration that is the basis for the supernormal powers. And then the fourth one, investigation, examines the mind and the factors that promote and hinder its development. Okay? So, fueled by a wish to investigate and realize nirvana, we strive to attain concentration because we see that concentration is essential for attaining nirvana. Okay, so that's the one of investigation. Okay, then we have the five faculties and the five powers. And these, the five and the five, these two sets have the same name. Okay, so, you know, there's the same qualities. But the thing is that when they're in the state of the five faculties, they're still unable to remedy their opposing forces, the opposing mental factors, whereas when they are strong enough to not be dislodged by their opposing mental factors, then they become the five powers. Okay, so what are these five? The first one is faith. The opposing one that it overcomes is non-faith. Yeah. So here faith is a mind that, especially the faith of conviction, that has faith and trust and confidence due to understanding. Non-faith is like the attitude of whatever, I don't know, Four Noble Truths, they're true, they're not true, I don't know, I don't care. Okay, if you have that kind of idea, are you going to get anywhere on the path? No. Okay. Then the second of the five is effort. You'll notice that some of these mental factors are coming repeatedly, okay, in all these different sets of the 37. So effort, the faculty of effort, is working against the factor of laziness, our old friend of laziness, that wants to either indulge in sleep, okay, and procrastinate, or keeps us very busy in all of our numerous distractions. Or another kind of laziness is being discouraged. Yeah. When we're discouraged, we don't think we're lazy. We think our discouragement is true. We are really inept and this is way too difficult. It's basically discouraged. It's basically laziness. Try saying that to yourself the next time you put yourself down. Yeah, the next time you say, oh, I can't do this, it's so hard. And say, oh, that's laziness. That's laziness. This is truth. No, Buddha said it's laziness. Well, Buddha's... I can't say Buddha's wrong. Maybe I need to investigate and see why Buddha said that discouragement is laziness. Why did he say discouragement is laziness?
Because it is.
Because it is. Because
it is. It sure feel like it.
Because when we get, this is my personal experience, I don't know really about a textbook answer, but when that mind of discouragement stops us from doing anything.
That's precisely it. Yeah. The mind of discouragement, why is it laziness? Because we don't do anything when we're discouraged. Except sit there and tell ourselves how bad we are and feel sorry for ourselves and blame it on the world.
But under that, the fear, we think we're not good enough, blah, 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 but I'm not good enough because I haven't tried. Why I haven't tried? Because it's too difficult, but too difficult why? I didn't put the effort to learn.
Yeah.
And this is laziness.
Yeah. Oh, that's very good the way you said it. Okay. So you don't do it, how you traced it back, is you're discouraged, so you don't try. And because you don't try, you're not making any effort. And so, of course, if you don't make effort, you're not going to get anywhere. So that's laziness, isn't it?
It is. We take the easy path. It's not like that, you know. But it's the easy path. I would not make the effort. My mom said that wasn't good, but yeah. I have tons of examples.
Yeah.
Not examples, but
Yeah, I don't even try because I'm not going to succeed anyway.
And that's how the ego plays this game.
Yeah.
But under that, it's pure laziness.
Yeah. Yeah, it is pure laziness, isn't it? And we have so many reasons why. Anyway, we're going to fail and it's too hard and so why should I try?
So I'm not going to do BBC
Monday. Huh? Okay, good. Good. Your next BBC talk. Cynthia, you had something?
It was about the same, not to be repetitive.
Yeah.
Like, we prefer to give up.
Yeah.
We prefer to give up. It's easier to give up than to make a serious effort and to keep trying.
Yeah.
In different ways.
Right.
And the pride get into that? You try to save face?
There's a lot of things in there. It's easier to not try than to try and fail. Because if we fail, then we've proven to ourselves how bad we are. And we've also lost faith in front of other people. Whereas if we don't try, then we just have the excuse, well, I've never tried and I don't think I can do it. But anyway, I'm good in all these other things.
Comes from a failure to understand dependent arising.
Yeah.
And Buddha nature.
Yeah. Yeah. OK. Okay, it sounds like we have a good understanding of laziness in this If we could only apply the understanding in practice.
I have to investigate.
And overcome it. Yes. You're investigating your laziness.
I do. And I came to conclusion. Mm. I am lazy.
Okay. Then the so the first of the five, faith, overcomes non-faith. Effort is the second one, overcomes laziness. Third one is mindfulness, our old friend mindfulness, okay? And it helps us overcome forgetfulness. What if we forget? We forget the objects of the four truths, the aspects of the four truths. You know, how we're supposed to meditate on the four truths. Because, you know, the four truths of the Aryas are the basic thing that you're trying to understand in the higher training of wisdom. Yeah? And so, mindfulness, you just forget what you're supposed to be meditating on. And then the fourth of the five faculties and five powers is concentration. And that eliminates its antidote, which are the five hindrances, okay, which we'll get into later. And then the fifth one is wisdom, and it overcomes the wrong conceptions about the four truths. And it individually discriminates and knows the objects of the four truths, the aspects of the four truths, their features, their qualities, and everything, okay? So when they're the state of faculties, yeah, then they are, you know, they're in the process of gaining strength and, you know, counteracting those five opposing factors. Can we add a sixth one that's called hiccups? So with the five faculties, we're still unable to remedy those five opposing factors. With the five powers, we're able to suppress them. Those five factors don't overcome us in our practice. However, we still haven't eliminated them completely. So what does the fact that we haven't eliminated them completely tell you?
We have not exerted effort to realize emptiness.
Yeah, that you haven't realized emptiness yet. Yeah, so that these are developed primarily path of accumulation, path of preparation.
So what is the wisdom power that you're developing then if it's not?
You're getting the correct view of emptiness, because before you can gain perception of emptiness, you have to have the correct conceptual understanding and then also the correct inference. Well, the correct conceptual understanding is the correct inference.
Well, could I just ask about that last comment you made? In the Mahayana tradition, these are associated with, the first three are associated with the three levels of the path of accumulation, and these faculties and powers are on the path of preparation. Is that different in the Pali tradition?
The Pali tradition, they don't talk about the five paths like that specifically. They do talk about seeing. They talk about meditating. Yeah, I think there's another term that they use, maybe for preparing, preparation or something. But they don't divide it into five paths, but they have similar basic kind of stages like that. Yeah, it's interesting that some things we take for granted, are seen in different ways in the tradition. Okay. Let's see if I have anything here. questions, comments? Yeah.
So then, after realizing emptiness directly, how does the mind's relationship to these change? Do you continue to use them in a different capacity?
Oh, yeah. You know, you develop these qualities, but they're all quite essential for your practice on, you know, to have faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. It isn't like you develop them on the lower paths and once you realize emptiness, you drop them because you don't need them anymore. In fact, you need them more than ever and they become stronger.
But within the sphere of emptiness, they take on a whole different importance.
Well, you're using them to support your realization, to gain your realization of emptiness. And you're using them also to collect merit on the path of seeing and meditation because you need that collection of merit also to advance through the bodhisattva stages. Okay? So if, you know, when we look and we see that many of these same mental factors come again and again and again, what is really in these different sets, what it's really emphasizing to us is how important these different mental factors are and the many different ways in which they are used and the many different contexts in which they are practiced. And so this helps us have a much broader understanding of what these mental factors are and how they function, instead of having a very narrow understanding. And even though in Vasubandhu and Asanga associate these different categories,
Vasubandhu.
Yeah, and Asanga, there's, I think, seven categories, aren't they? Yeah, so they associate these seven categories with different levels of the paths, yeah? They don't agree on all of the way they associate them. In actual fact, in the way from the perspective of the Pali tradition, is you start developing these different factors right from the get-go at the beginning of your practice. So it's not that you wait until the path of accumulation to start meditating on the four establishments of mindfulness. No, you know, you're doing that from the very get-go of your practice, you know, and you're trying to generate faith and aspiration and effort and all these things even before you've entered a path. Yeah. They like correlating different things with different stages and levels. I can't say I always understand what the correlations are. Yeah, but that may be my limitation. Yes.
Does the intermediate being and the advanced being, do they practice the 37 in the same way or differently?
Oh, okay. So do the intermediate and advanced being, according to Longren, practice these seven categories in the same way? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. In some ways, yes. The explanation pertains to both, to here solitary realizers and bodhisattvas. But from another way the bodhisattva practices them and the motivation behind practicing them are different. So, for example, with the mindfulness of the body, yeah, if you're doing it to attain liberation, you basically focus on your own body. Or maybe the body of somebody that you're sexually attracted to in order to calm desire. And that's it. Bodhisattvas will meditate on the mindfulness of the body, of both self and others, and see how the body, you know, it keeps us all trapped in samsara. And develops not only the determination to be free from samsara for ourselves, but compassion for other living beings who are attached to their body, enslaved by their body, and so on. Okay? So similarly, a bodhisattva would look at the mindfulness of feelings and think, wow, sentient beings are just buffeted around like all get out by their feelings. You know, they're happy one moment and generate attachment and commit negative karmas. They're unhappy the next moment, get upset about that, generate more negative karma, you know. And they'll look at sentient beings and how they relate to their feelings and generate compassion, which they use to fuel their bodhicitta, you know. Then I really have to become enlightened to be able to benefit sentient beings and help prevent them from being like that. Okay? Now, similarly, I was saying for attaining the four supernormal powers, you know, that everybody in the fundamental vehicle path, the hearers and solitary realizers, not all of them develop those four supernormal powers. They have a choice to develop them or not. Bodhisattvas will develop them because they're very important for receiving teachings yourself and being able to benefit sentient beings. Yeah.
So, speaking of, you're talking about the supernormal powers. So, walking on water, right? I have to admit, I have a little difficulty with that. What exactly is the point of that?
There seems to be an important point in it for Christianity.
Right, yeah.
Who
took that as the real
matter? Yeah. But I would say the important point is if you have to get somewhere quickly and there's a huge body of water, you know, you have to arrive at a teaching quickly. If you can walk across that water, you know, it's going to save you a lot of time rather than going around.
It could be ice.
Pardon? What did you say?
It could be ice.
Ice.
Ice. If you're walking on water, it could be that we're walking on ice.
Oh, I'm walking on ice, yes. Okay. Yeah?
You talked about generating faith. Could you say a little bit more about that?
It's faith in the teachings, in the method. Two, it's faith in the four truths, and then faith in the method that the Buddha taught about how to purify our mind, how to realize the nature of reality.
So faith is it coming by?
It's coming.
Learning,
it's
teaching.
It's.
Is it that would make your faith grow?
Well, there's different kinds of faith. Some kind of faith comes because you hear of these qualities and it just makes your heart sing. You don't understand them so well, but they sound really good. And so it just, your heart sings with appreciation. A deeper kind of faith is you learn about the four truths or the various qualities of bodhisattvas and you aspire to attain them. And then yet another kind of faith is you hear about these things and you really think about them and you examine the method that's taught for how to understand them and you have confidence in that method.
So okay. In order to have faith, do you have to have an experience, a direct experience?
No, not necessarily. Like the first kind, you hear about it. You know, first of all, the word faith is, don't think of it as what we usually call faith in English.
For me, it's more like a devotion.
Yeah.
Feeling of hope. And
yeah, it includes that, but it goes deeper than that. Yeah, because the more you understand, the more
strong, solid.
Yes. You know, initially, our faith is a little bit wimpy. Because somebody else tells us something else that sounds good, then we'll have faith in that. But as we develop experience, as we develop understanding, then it becomes firmer. Okay? And it actually means like confidence or trust. Yeah, the English word faith is not a good translation. But there's no really good English word that describes all the kind of implications. You know, but there is that element of feeling uplifted. Yeah, this mental factor has the functions to uplift your mind and to motivate you.
Could you say conviction?
That's a kind of faith, when we have strong conviction in something. Yeah.
Is a deeper level of that, like actually relying on the teachings when you're going through hardship?
Yeah, exactly. You know, when our confidence or our trust in the Buddha Dharma Sangha is stable, then when we have problems, we're able to rely on the teachings. When it's not stable, we have a problem, and what do we do?
Go to the fortune teller.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about how this view of faith is, in a way, an antidote to the laziness of discouragement.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from this ability to me, almost like you have a more of an experimental attitude towards what's going on than the usual emotion of, you know, I can or I can't, or this sucks or whatever. But it's more like I try something. If I try something and look at it in a more, for me the word scientific, but if I try to do something and I don't succeed right away, but I pay attention to what I did and then I can adjust, if I have faith in that idea that if I see what I do, really pay attention and adjust and try again, see if that works and try again, then I don't have that fear of failure and I don't get into that laziness of, oh, this will never work, because I see a path. Even though I'm not there yet, I see a path.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Faith gives us the ability to see a path, to know that then we can, yeah, adjust and continue and get somewhere. Yeah. So it isn't just, you know, blind faith. You know, like, oh, somebody said you can fly in the sky. Yes, I believe it. I want to fly in the sky.
Also, I think what gives me the confidence is like examples of the math.
The example of what?
For his audience, for example.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, seeing these teachings manifest in him gives me great inspiration and confidence.
Yeah. It gives us admiring faith. It gives us aspiring faith. If he did it, so can I. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
One more thing is that I've learned to trust that this faith based on reasoning, if I look over my life and I see how I've applied the teachings in a reasonable, practical, personal way, that increases the faith. Like, I always thought that reasoning had to be some sort of abstraction that was disengaged from myself.
Mm-hmm.
But reasoning is actually applying them in a way that works, see the success of it, and then let those things build on themselves. I always thought that reasoning was, an abstraction that didn't have anything to do with my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So now I've got that, it's growing. My faith is that I see for myself, I am a testimonial to the use of the Dharma, how it works. And so that's where I put my reasoning, is my own direct integration of what I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, your own experience becomes a reason.
It's a reason, right.
To have confidence in the teachings. Start with the seven awakening factors.